This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Hey everyone, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets, in the car while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, it's Doug Gottlieb. Welcome in. This is All Ball, the podcast you love. We tell stories, or we allow other people to come and tell stories about their storied career. We talk a little hoops in the meantime. I do want to give you a thought on the issues within the Miami Heat. And as you guys know, if you listen to this pod, I love the idea of culture. I love that they kind of load to the basketball, that they make you make contested shots, that they play together, that it's about toughness and versatility defensively. And I'm also realized that they're not healthy, right? I get it. But we also have to give a little bit of respect for guys that can just go get buckets. Like, all the other stuff is hard. Playing the NBA is hard. There's no role that you have that's easy. Okay. I mean, I remember Steve Kerr. I think it was in the 2002 NBA Finals. I went to game six in Jersey, and maybe I'll tell that story again. That's actually how I got my first NBA draft gig at ESPN Radio. But I remember going to game six, and Steve Kerr didn't play in the first half. And yet in the second half, you remember that game, he came off the bench. And maybe it was game five. I think it was game five. And hit three threes, replaced Tony Parker, and kind of won in the game, won in the series. And I remember walking out of the building that night thinking, do people understand how hard it is what Steve Kerr just accomplished? Do people understand that? To sit there the whole game, and then, oh yeah, by the way, to start the second half, after halftime, he and Steve Smith must have gotten the sign they were going to go play. They come sprinting out of the locker room and get a bunch of shots up. But to sit there for like an hour and a half, 2 hours, get the call, come in, be open, have to make shots. And oh yeah, by the way, guard Jason Kidd at the other end. That's an incredibly hard role. But the hardest role remains, hey, when the house is on fire, you can lead them out. Can you go get me a bucket? Right? The amount of energy expended doing that is greater than any other energy in the NBA. So I respect that. And I think it's what the Heat are missing. You know, like, look, when they won championships, they had LeBron or they had Dwayne Wade. When they haven't, they've had really, really good teams that allow them to consistently be competitive, but they don't have a bucket getter. And Jimmy Butler's a very, very good player. There's a difference between very, very good player and star or superstar. And therein lies the difference. You know, that's just not, he's at his best when he's your second or third best offensive player. When he's your best offensive player, that's not really what he does. He can still score 25 a night, okay, but he can't be counted on to score 25 a night. Make sense? All right, more on that to come. Let me get you to part two of my conversation with J.D. Collins.
Do you remember the moment that you felt like I've made it? Right, like do you remember the big game where was it? Because oftentimes, like you mentioned, the former commissioner of the MAC who became the coordinator in the, because like that's, I mean, look, we look at the list right before the game, like, oh, I mean, and then there's always a guy like, I have no idea who that human being is, and then you get to a point where like, oh, JD, I know what JD is. I mean, all right, we're good. Was it a moment where a big name coach, you know, knew you by name and you had a relationship? Was it a big game? Was it a Final Four? Was there a moment where you're like, I have kind of arrived?
You know, I don't know that I can think that I've arrived. I even in my job that I'm in now, I don't know. I think we all are in a learning process. But three things came to mind when you asked that question about a moment. I worked in the Elite Eight in Albuquerque with Tim Higgins and Eddie Hightower, Louisville, West Virginia. Louisville is down 24 points at the half, and Louisville comes back, double overtime, wins by one, and goes to the Final Four. I remember working that game, and not that it was perfect, not that the three of us were perfect or anything like that, but it was the atmosphere was such, and I think it might have been 2005, the atmosphere was such that processing through it, handling the game, not having an impact on who won, who lost that game, that was a pretty cool moment. The second one is not a moment of arrival, but it's a moment that you know that you're heading in the right direction. I was fortunate enough to work as the alternate official in the 2004 Final Four in San Antonio, and sitting there watching it, I remember the words in my head, hey, I think I can do this. I mean, I can work the Final Four, whatever. Hank Nichols assigned me to that game, dear friend, or those games. I was there all weekend. 4 years later, I'm back in San Antonio, working UCLA and Memphis, and I knew that I could handle that game. I didn't think I could. I knew I could. And so that process of the next 4 years, working literally each coordinator of the Power Leagues and the Big East, gave me games that, I mean, night in and night out were just hard. The backyard brawl between Pittsburgh and West Virginia. I mean, Indiana, Purdue, Michigan State, whatever it is, you then know that you can handle these games because kind of been there, done that. And there's nothing going to happen that's going to get go wrong in the game. And I say that to say coordinators assign referees on the game differently than they assign U1s and U2s. The referee is responsible for that game. And I always took it that it was my job to make sure nothing went wrong in that game, whether it was fan behavior, player behavior, coach behavior, I was going to handle it. And that 4 year segment between 04 and 08 was truly the learning part of getting me to that point. If there is ever a point of aha, as you're describing it, it's that journey you're in along the way. Now, going back to the Louisville, West Virginia game, I had one opportunity in my career, Louisville, West Virginia. I call a foul. I think his number is 24. J.D. Collins calling a foul on J.D. Collins, the player from West Virginia.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Right? And Hightower was with me, and Hightower's a trail. Boom. He takes the call to the table, and I am devastated. I'm like, Ed, I get to halftime. I'm like, Ed, I had the chance to call a foul on J.D. Collins. Are you kidding me? Well, he didn't particularly understand what I was trying to communicate there. But that being said, I think it's more of a journey, Doug, than it is a moment. Now, getting done with the Final Four, that was in 08 that I worked on the floor. My knee blew out in 09, so my career ended at that point on the floor. But after the game, I walk out into the arena. It was really funny because Tom Crean was sitting in the second row right behind me. I walk out, turn on my cell phone, 60 messages, you know, just getting pounded by the people that wanted to celebrate working the game. And Tom says to me, "Hey, JD," and he's coming from the Big East to the Big Ten. And he said, I always thought Big East officials sucked. And he was kidding. He was busting my chops. Yes. I said, "Hey, Tom, Big Ten's my primary. I'll see you in the fall." It was a great moment. And I have the utmost respect for him. But that moment when I listened to the first message, I'm sitting there, the second game's getting ready to start. And I listened to the first message and it hits you. It hits you that you've just had the opportunity to referee in front of 75,000 people for the first time. You did well. You didn't screw anything up. That moment is one that I, you know, I shot my phone off and left the arena, went back to the hotel room and enjoyed life.
So. Was it all like, what was the goal? To just grow? Was the goal to get to the Final Four? Like, you know, as you climb, like, it's like, I tell people all the time, like, my goal, like, all I want to do is I want to start 4 years in college. And then my goal was really, I just want to play one day in the NBA. I thought if things worked out right, I could play in the NBA. But if I just had one day where I walked into a locker room and there's an NBA jersey and my last name on the back, like, that's, I'm good. Right. I wanted to play in a Final Four. You know, things you want to do. Was there a goal? Was that a goal along the way, or was it, or were you a just keep growing, progressing sort of guy? What was your mentality?
I think achieving excellence is what the overall goal is. And the way you mark that is what level you achieve. And so getting the opportunity to work the Final Four says you are an elite level that you can attach to, but your peers attach to as well. Really every, you know, the 100 guys that I use in the NCAA tournament, every one of them wants to work the Final Four. And then every one of them wants to work the championship game. And then every one of them wants to be the guy tossing the ball at the championship game. Because in the reality, every other official besides the guy that gets to toss the ball at the Final Four was second, third, fourth, 90th, 100th. You know, that nobody's ever happy. Ever, ever, ever. It's the Final Four is what officials want to work to acknowledge their status level in the business.
How'd you blow your knee?
You know, I runner all my life. I put a lot of road miles in with a couple dogs. Then add to that refereeing, stop, start. Had multiple knee surgeries. And on December 16th, I was at Ohio University and a player went to the corner and I had to run around him and I felt my knee pop. I kept refereeing, you know, drain my knee, get a shot, do whatever. December 30th at Michigan State against Texas Southern, it blew up the size of a pumpkin and I knew I was done. You know, quite frankly, both knees bone on bone. I had used them up. I was 47 years old. Went to my surgeon New Year's Eve and said, "Hey, help me fix this. I need to keep refereeing." And he's like, "Dude, you're done. You are done. You have to have your knee replaced." Boom, boom, boom. And away we went. There are officials.
So you didn't finish even that year?
I did not. I shut it down on December 30th. Had my knee replaced on March the 18th. And you go on with life. And there are officials today who have knee replacements and physically work themselves back to the point where they can referee. Several NCAA level Final Four guys have done this. In my path, had my right knee replaced. I know my left knee needed it. If I went back on the floor, it would just it's a matter of one season or whatever. And I choose value of life over the ability to play golf, the ability to hike with my wife, the ability to do things. I chose that over going back on the floor and fighting that battle just for another basketball game.
So then how did you progress into coordinating officials as opposed to doing it yourself?
So I that was March of 10, and in March of 11, the Big Ten hired me. They just hired Rick Boyajis as a coordinator of officials, and Rick came from the coaching side. So Jim Delaney hired me to be an assistant there. The following year, became the MAC and some, or the MAC and the Summit League coordinator, and helped the Big Ten. So it was a natural progression from on the floor to administrative, and trying to teach and train guys to do what I had done on the floor. Did that for 5 years, and then the NCAA position opened, and I felt that it was the right move. I thought it was the right challenge, and literally thrilled to death that I made that change. And I've loved being in the role I'm in for 7 years.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notified, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Awards Watch says Liam Neeson is at his best. Don't miss In the Land of Saints and Sinners. Having left his dark past behind, retired hitman Finbar Murphy, played by Neeson, leads a quiet life in a remote coastal Irish town. But when a menacing crew of terrorists arrive, Finbar is drawn into a vicious game of cat and mouse, forcing him to choose between exposing his secret identity or defending his friends and neighbors. In the Land of Saints and Sinners, from Samuel Goldwyn Films and Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. Watch it now on digital. Rated R.
So college bat, you we started by talking about decorum of fans and a little bit officials. I think the first thing is that people believe, and you mentioned back in the Horizon League, hey, I don't want to hire a guy from Indiana. Don't want to think, you know, we're, is the idea of biases. Sure. And it's hard because you do at some point you've been doing it for, you know, how long you've been doing it for. You get to, whether you have a real relationship with people, there's people that you like you just like them, you know, and there's people that you don't like, but you have to call the game fair. In your heart of hearts, do you believe that you're able to officiate without any bias?
The answer equivocally is yes. When you first start refereeing, you know, people go, is a makeup call a possibility? You do that once in your career where you miss a call and then you miss a second one on purpose and you realize you never catch up. And so that thought goes away.
I don't want to interrupt your thought, but I will point out that what I find to be really good officiating sometimes, and it's harder now with replay, is you might miss a call and then the ball goes out of bounds and you right the wrong by giving it to the team that the call was missed on. So Yes.
You know, 20 years ago, you might have been able to pull that off occasionally.
Yeah.
But the reality and the better play is a guy goes over the top and is fouling a guy from behind. And we know that it went out on White.
Yes.
But we pass on the foul and we give the ball
right
back to White.
Yes.
Okay. That's a better example because there's two parts to that play. But the reality is
it's hard to replay.
You can never catch it up and it doesn't exist. Your question to me is, can you do it without bias? And you, just like you as a fan or your fans that watch games, without question, they're biased toward the red jersey or the blue jersey. Without question, you have to train yourself not to have bias. And I would, you know, a little footnote here. I think you have to do that in life as well.
I do. I think what people, this is their one place. This is their one, like, that's honestly the hardest thing in my job is, you know, people like, you played at Oklahoma State, so you automatically hate XYZ. Like,
no,
this school didn't offer you a scholarship. So like, it turned out okay for me. That was 20 years ago. That has nothing to do with anything now.
Like, you can be trained to have bias.
Yes.
Whether that's in basketball or in life, you can train yourself to have no bias, especially as you're operating at a professional level. And, you know, let's talk about my job. I choose 100 officials to work the NCAA tournament and advance them through the tournament. I will promise you, I don't like all 100 of them. Okay. Some of them are people that their approach to life is completely opposite of mine. They have different values.
Sure.
I don't really like them, but you know what? My job is to put the best officials on the floor.
Yeah.
No matter whether I like them or not, you can train yourself to not have bias. And I will tell you, I know that's, you know, from a fan perspective, that's the number one thing. Oh, this guy, when he refs our games, you know what? I had Gene Cady 1 year, 11 times. They went 2-9 with me. Gene thought I was a horrible official that year. The following year, I had them 7 times and they went 6-1 with me. And he literally asked the coordinator of officials, did JD go through a divorce last year or whatever? No, your team sucked. They weren't very good. Okay. This has nothing to do with my bias. Amazing. Has nothing to do with my bias toward team A, team B, or team C. It's about training yourself not to be.
Okay. How about this one? What is it like? You're a young official. Okay. This is a very basketball thing. I think one of the hardest things for like John Shire this year at Duke is going to be, is completely different when John Shire's over there trying to talk to you and ask you for a call as opposed to the old man, right? It just is. But as an official, is it like, you know, the thought is, for example, Coach K, I mean, he's USA basketball. He's, you know,
he's got a pedigree.
So you're doing a game, you're a young official and you're looking over there and one guy has won 700 games and is in the Hall of Fame. And the other guy is just coming up. Doesn't mean you're going to screw the other guy, but it's a lot harder. You know, it's like God himself is coaching that one team. What is that like to not allow that to affect your officiating?
Well, I'm gonna move the bar just a second and then come back to that.
Okay.
My first Division I game in an exhibition game was at Indiana University with Coach Knight.
Perfect.
First Division I game. Okay. I'm with Steve Wellmer and Eric Harmon.
Okay.
During the game, I go to the C slot in front of Coach Knight. He picks me up. He literally stood up, picked me up, and moved me to the side because he wanted to see the game.
Right.
Now, if that happened 20 years into my career, 15 years into my career, I give him a technical foul and move on. Not going to happen. But my partners, because it was an exhibition game and easy for them, they rotated so that I was in front of Coach Knight every time down the floor. I had no choice but to be in front of Coach Knight on my first Division I game. All right. Now, fast forward, I refereed in the Big Ten from 1990 to certainly through 2000 while he was in the Big Ten. So I had Coach Knight a lot. And there is a point in everyone's career where you have to stand on your own 2 feet.
Sure.
And going back to the Duke thing, it's walking on the floor before a game. You've been in the league for 15 years. Assistant coach from team A comes over. Hey, JD, gives you some man love, blah, 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 blah. A lot of guys don't pay attention to that, referees. When that would happen to me, I would go find an assistant coach from the team I didn't know.
Sure.
Introduce myself, give them some brother love, and away we'd go. Why would I do that? Because I wanted everyone to understand that I'm going to treat everyone exactly the same, no matter of pedigree, no matter of whatever. Now, one coach, best example I can give you is Coach Pitino when he was at Louisville. If you had Louisville and fill-in-the-blank team, and you listened to the fill-in-the-blank team's coach for 15 seconds, one of Coach Pitino's major things is, no matter what happened in the game, he's taking 15 seconds down there. He's going to get in your ear for 15 seconds. Okay?
Yeah, he wants equal time.
If it's 30 seconds, he's taking 30. But he's going to get his equal time. And early in my career, I understood that process and understood that it doesn't really matter. And you say, well, give me an example of that. Okay. December 26th, nobody's playing, and I get an assignment of North Carolina at Rutgers. Okay? Only game on in America. North Carolina's winning by 20 points. Hansborough goes to the hole, gets a little bit of a foul, but it's not enough. And I point the other way, blah, blah, blah. Coach jumps in the air, lands on the floor. Before he lands, I whack him. I hit him with a technical foul. Completely upsets him beyond, you know, any normal fate. I can't believe that. That's the cheapest technical. He's all over me. We do the technical foul at the other end. We come back, and I make my partner switch up, so I'm in front of him. I'm in front of Roy.
Yeah.
And Roy goes, JD, that's the cheapest technical foul. I said, Roy, not personal. You can't do that on my floor. And he goes, it's not personal? I go, no, Roy, it's not personal. Now, keep in mind, I also knew that every coach in America was watching North Carolina at Rutgers that night.
Sure, sure.
The next month of my season, I didn't hear Boo Jack Diddley from a single coach that I had.
Right.
But if he's going to whack Roy Williams on national television, right, he's certainly going to give me a technical foul.
Sure. Sure.
Okay. So for me, I just think, again, you train yourself not to have bias. You train yourself to treat people equally. It's the right thing to do. And that's what we as coordinators have to teach and train.
How about this is a question. What about the energy of the home momentum run, right? Like, it does feel like officials, all of a sudden, the home team hits a couple shots, get a couple steals. Now there's a block charge. And it's, I mean, when you point the other way, the whole place explodes.
I thought you were just sharing with me that the other team is feeling that pressure and it affects their performance. And therefore that's why all that stuff happens.
I don't think there's any.
See what I did there, Doug?
Yes, of course it is. I don't think there's any doubt that happens, right? Like, one, the home team does become more aggressive and the road team does become more passive. But again, we're dealing with human beings here.
Sure.
And you're a human being and you feel that. That's why you do it, right? It's the energy of these buildings. That's what separates.
Want to be in that moment.
Right. So what is it like and how do you maintain your kind of emotional balance in these moments so that you're not biased?
Right. Right. I think it's really a matter of, again, training yourself not to be biased, training yourself for those big moments and making sure that a block charge play at this point is the same as a block charge play at that point, and not getting caught up in that emotion. Because the reality is we're wrong 50% of the time every call we make, right? We're just wrong 50% of the time, meaning we call a play against red, we're wrong. We call it to the other end, we call a play against blue, we're wrong. That's just the way it is. And so you learn through training, through going through the steps of moving up and officiating, you learn not to have that kind of a negative situation impact you.
But you also, how do you do it? As you mentioned, you're part of a team, right?
Right.
So if you're part of a team, there's good, sometimes there's another official who may get, I don't want to say influenced, but who may make a call. And sometimes it's based upon it. How do you handle that when you're sitting there and you're like, you know, it's not, you don't agree with it, but you are a teammate at the time.
Yeah. And obviously we're talking about the highest level, you know, I hate to make this comparison, but how cool was watching the PGA tournament this past weekend? It is the best of the best. Some performed well under pressure. Some did not. And that's going to happen night in and night out.
How about me though? Like, man, that 18th hole was hard to watch.
But you know what? He's going to have another 18th hole a couple years from now. He's going to have another 18th hole.
There's some scar tissue there that's got to be.
But that's how we learn. And that's how we keep that from happening in the future. I'm doing a loose comparison of the PGA golfers to our college basketball officials. Even your asking the question indicates that you think it happens more often than not. And that's not the case. That's just not the case. We miss calls, Doug. There's no question. We miss calls, not because we want to, because we're in a bad position. We didn't see the whole play. You know, if you see a block charge play and you're over here looking and all of a sudden there's a block charge play and it happens, you're seeing this much of the play. If I'm in position and I see a block charge play develop, happen, and finish, it's in slow motion. It goes in slow motion. So there's ways to put yourself in a better position to make those calls correctly. And it just the thought of just even the thinking behind this is not the way a referee's mind works. That's why I asked,
not because I assume.
Yeah.
The other one that you'll get is, well, you know, he's working too many games. That's why he missed that one, right? He's tired. He's working too many games. All these guys, they want to make more money, you know, so they do too many games. How much does mental travel fatigue affect your ability, or did it affect your ability to perform under pressure?
Okay. I'll use my scenario to make a point. Up until 2006, I was president CEO of a corporation. There are a lot of decisions had to be made on a daily basis, flying private to do this. And I thought that I was a pretty good official at that point. Sell the business, just refereeing full time. I'm flying into a city. I referee 4 or 5 games in that city over a 3 or 4 day period. I'm sleeping well, I'm eating well, I'm exercising well. I was a much better official in that scenario, and I was working a lot of games, okay? I think the answer to the question is, it depends on your scenario. Some guys can work 70 games a year and it's the perfect number. Some guys can work 90 games a year and it's the perfect number. What I would ask you is, do you think any of those golfers in the PGA Championship, if they left last weekend's tournament, did not play practice rounds, did not do anything until Thursday morning, they walked out and they started playing for the PGA Championship. Do you think they'd be very good?
No.
The answer is no. They have a rhythm that, you know, the actual question I've been given from officials is, you know, you have a requirement, JD, that we can't referee when you're in the NCAA tournament, you can't referee for 3 or 4 days before your tournament game. Officials feel they would rather have a repetition in there because that's their normal. That's what they do. And so there's a balancing point there. And the bigger fear for the NCAA tournament is that an official referees on Tuesday, he's got a game on Thursday, he gets injured. And now we have a problem. We have to replace somebody. So I think that the number of games worked per week is more about what's the appropriate repetition for that particular official. Does he have a full-time job? Does he not have a full-time job? Is he refereeing full-time? There is a cadence to what we do that's the right number for each and every official. And I think it's different for each and every official.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, You'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game. We're now joined by three-time NBA Sixth Man of the Year, elite bucket getter. Let's please welcome Jamal Crawford to Point Game, King of the Court one-on-one tournament. If they had it back in your prime, do you think you could have took it all?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I could have took it all, but I think I would have shocked a lot of people. I think Kobe and everybody in their prime, Kobe would win a one-on-one contest.
Yeah, because you got to think, he's going to guard. He don't care about guarding.
He's going to guard.
He's going to guard. Like, you see him in the Olympics, he's going to guard. And then on top of that.
I'm not guarding like that, CJ.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam Cassell to Point Game.
I remember you came to my room crying tears. he was in a culture shock. And then he's going to withdraw us about winning.
Remember what I told you? I said, OG, you think I can get paid and go back and play in college because it ain't it?
Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Awards Watch says Liam Neeson is at his best. Don't miss In the Land of Saints and Sinners. Having left his dark past behind, retired hitman Finbar Murphy, played by Neeson, leads a quiet life in a remote coastal Irish town. But when a menacing crew of terrorists arrive, Finbar is drawn into a vicious game of cat and mouse, forcing him to choose between exposing his secret identity or defending his friends and neighbors. In the Land of Saints and Sinners, from Samuel Goldwyn Films and Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. Watch it now on digital. Rated R.
We mentioned Black Charge. I think, this is a personal opinion, okay, that with the charge circle, we're asking officials to do, there's only one other type of officiating that does the exact same, that does a similar thing, and that's baseball umpires. When you have a check swing to see if the guy went through. Mm-hmm. So the umpire is behind the catcher. They have to determine ball or strike. And then they're trying to determine if a guy went when you don't have the angle. That's not what you're concentrating on, right? Okay. So for block charge, you have to determine if the, and I, again, I don't know how it's taught. Okay. But it seems to be that we go kind of ground up, right? Because mm-hmm. we're trying to see if one, they're outside the circle, two, if their feet are some form of being set. Mm-hmm. And then you're looking at the contact. That makes it really difficult to see, was the guy set when he goes into the motion of it, right? When he starts going towards the hoop, like when are the feet set? Like you get so focused on the feet being inside and outside that line that everything else becomes secondary or tertiary. And it's almost an impossible ask of one official to see block or charge. Now, first, how is it taught? And secondly, how can you break down those separate things that are occurring at a very, very similar.
So first of all, the NBA rule, you explained it, and that's the gather. When they gather, that guy's got to be there. Yeah. That's refereeing both the offensive player and the defensive player. In college, it isn't the gather. It's when I leave the floor.
Right.
And the way we teach officials is we referee the defense exclusively. Okay. And if the defender has reached legal guarding position, 2 feet on the floor facing his opponent, prior to that guy taking off, which is generally within the same 4 foot area, I find defense feet down. Is he up or is he not? Block charge. If he is there before he takes off, I know the defense is legal. There's only one call that can be made. Two, actually. One's a player control foul. The other is a no call, depending on if there's enough contact. So for us, I don't think the block charge play is hard to call. the restricted area does make it difficult because you got to find where their feet are at relative to the restricted area. But if they're 2 feet facing their opponent and they're legal, the bottom line is you can't call a blocking foul on that player. So it makes it really simple. And I would tell you, yeah, players are faster, stronger, quicker, and those plays happen in an instant. But like I alluded to earlier, if you're in the right position and you see it coming and you identify the defense, all that stuff goes in slow motion. If you're in the wrong position and you're trying to find it, yeah, it's going to be really difficult. That's why positioning is so critical to what we do. Back in 2012, you know, I hear the music out there that we're calling too many player control fouls. The reality is that may or may not be true, but the reality is Art Hyland and myself have spent the last 2 years teaching our referees what legal guarding position is, and they're doing a tremendous job of adhering to the rules that we have. And given that fact, our call actually rate on block charge plays is extremely high, given our current rules. Now, certain pundits don't like that. Well, great, change the rules. That's pretty simple.
If you could design the rules, which would be better for everybody,
I'm for
the greatest percentage of people. Like, you know, you're never going to please everybody. But if you were to say, hey, this is I've been doing this a long time. I'm riding off in the sunset. It doesn't matter. Well, let me just tell you what it should be. This is what it should be.
This is counterintuitive to our current rules. We have an arc play there, which was designed. The arc was designed to keep people out of there, right? Keep people out of there.
And when it's the opposite.
And now we say you can get in there if you jump vertically and you wall up legally. That's a great defensive play. We're never going to move that backward. But if we're going to have an arc on the floor to keep people out of there, then don't let anybody go in there. Now, the difference people apply the NBA look to our game. The reality is, for the first 90% of an NBA game, nobody plays defense anyhow. And if you beat somebody to the basket, we're going to let you score because it's all about scoring. It's all about entertainment. Our game is not that. We have 50% of the coaches who are defensively minded, and they want the ability to jump in and take that charge because they taught their players correctly. We have 50% of the coaches that go, no, this is an offensive game, and we got to allow our guys to blow through
when
that.
When you say don't let anybody in there, like you're never – like it's a – you never allowed to be in there?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. If you want the basket to be open and you put lines on the floor for that, then don't let anybody in there. Add to that we've had in the last 5, 7, 10 years – offense-initiated contact has moved up to an extreme high.
Yes.
So, therefore, offensive-minded coaches are teaching their players, drive to the basket as hard as you can, hit somebody, and put a shot up. We'll get fouls on that 22% of the time or whatever they figure out. That's a problem, too, and we have no way to adjust that thinking. We have no way to adjust it. Well, you can call player control fouls, but – by the way, on the current rule we have, which is pretty good, people don't like us calling player control fouls because it takes points off the board. So,
well, I think what they don't like is they don't like, yes, it's the when a guy is dribbling laterally, you know, where he feels like you just take a dive at somebody's arm or whatever. Or the I thought what happened, especially during the freedom of movement era, was, you know, it got that's when it first became the offense initiated contact. And then as it kind of got dialed back, the defense would close up that space to where the offense is left with no choice. Like you physically can't move unless you kind of get a guy off you. And now when you get a guy off you, they all take a dive and it becomes very difficult for an official. Like, is that a real dive or do you really get hit? You know, you got the guys throwing their head back all the time when they're dribbling, all those other kind of tricks to the trade, if you will. I'll tell you what I like is I would like the elimination of the offensive basket interference. That one's an easy one. And I think it also makes officials' jobs a lot easier as well, or that's not something that you have to worry about. Like the cylinder rule, it's hard. How can I tell if the ball is exactly out of the cylinder? So get rid of the rule. That's what they have.
FIBA has FIBA has a rule that once the ball hits the rim, it's free play. Anybody can do anything, offensive or defensively.
Do you like that?
I refereed FIBA ball for 7 years, and I loved it because it's an athletic play, it's an exciting play, and you take hard judgments on whether it was in, was it out. Awesome. I personally like that.
Yeah,
it has been discussed at the rules meeting the last couple of years. I think it will continue to be discussed, and potentially someday, well, we may move to that. But I think it's, you know, you and I would agree on that that concept. It's
I like the 15. Game. I also like in FIBA the 14-second or 15-second reset on offensive rebounds. Just speeds it up. You know, you don't need to bring it out and setting some up. Just get it and go again and again and again. What is that like to go from? I mean, it's kind of similar to your job in life to go from officiating to coordinating, because as much as you still got to go and observe, you're not doing it. And there's an energy to doing it. Right. What's that like? What's that like to, especially those first couple years?
People ask me all the time, hey, do you miss officiating? And my answer is always the same every day. Every day I miss it, because I think in life, we're all, you know, God makes us all for a certain thing. And I was made to referee. Then I didn't have the ability to referee. And I think refereeing is not that hard. I think we have a set of rules. You apply the rules. You apply the art of the game, the science of the game. I don't think it's that hard. And I watch referees on certain nights, I watch referees do things and make it hard. We make it hard on ourselves. And that's really frustrating for me to watch, because
how do people make it hard themselves?
Calling a play that's a nominal play a foul when the next, you know, the previous play down the floor, there was an obvious foul and we didn't put a whistle on it. That's inconsistent. And we put a nominal foul here. We don't see the game from a consistency perspective, and we make it difficult. And everyone doesn't do that, but I'll tell you, to your question, that's what's frustrating for me as a former referee who wants to referee. All you got to do is be right on your calls, be consistent, and be able to communicate with coaches, and you'll have the greatest career in the world. It's pretty simple.
Why do you think? Let me start a question. What's the percentage of Division I officials who are former Division I players?
Not as high as you would think. My guess is 5-7%.
Why do you think the number is what it is?
Because players, yourself included, who had the ability to play at a high level Division I, to a certain degree, they have talent, they have skill. They're in a great environment with all kinds of perks that come to them. And oh, by the way, you got to, in refereeing, you heard my journey, high school ball, small college ball, 6-hour drives, $65. No, I'm not interested in that. If I can get in and work 2 years and then you put me in the Final Four, oh yeah, I'm your guy.
That's it.
That's not what develops great referees. And so I think there's a dichotomy between the expectation of a player and the expectation of the journey you need to go through to be truly a successful referee. Now, that said, I think former players have a great feel for the game,
right?
And referees need feel. They need the art of the game to match the science of the game. I would love to see more players get involved in officiating, certainly with the shortages that are happening at the lower levels.
I agree. I mean, I completely agree. But it's the guys have to understand the process of it. And,
it's a hard journey.
It's a hard journey, but it's hard for guys that you're like, look, we didn't play. Yeah, I played JV basketball for half of one season, right? You know, like we didn't have to do that. Now, when you go to college, you don't start right away. You transfer to somewhere you can start, right? Yeah. So guys that never truly had to put in the work, they put in the work in their game, but they've never put in the work in terms of hey, here's how it works. You start here, you gotta pay for a refereeing camp, right? Like, yeah. no, when I played, somebody would fly me and give me shoes and gear. Like, no, that don't work that way. That doesn't work that way.
It's a long, hard journey to achieve either being at the highest level in men's college basketball or getting to the NBA officiating. It's a hard, hard journey. And the commitment to see that through is it takes a lot of commitment.
It's rare. It is rare. Who's the GOAT? Who's the guy that if you ask officials, college officials, that's the best guy to ever do it?
You know, I'm always hesitant to put one name on that because, as you know, in as they look at the NBA players now, players 20 years ago, players 40 years ago, the guys 40 years ago get left off, and they, in fact, may have been the best ever.
No question.
So
it's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, right? Six MVPs, six titles, yet no one, all-time leading scorer, never made a three-pointer, yet everybody completely dismisses him as the greatest. No, he's not even in the discussion of greatest player of all time. So I understand that. But of the you've been doing this since, let's just go since 90, so last 30 years.
Well, what I would tell you is, I mean, you can't argue with Jimmy Burr with 16 Final Fours. You can't argue with John Cal, I think, worked 10 Final Fours. You can't argue with Ed Hightower, 12 Final Fours. Those are statements about a journey. You can't argue with John Higgins, 9 Final Fours. When I was refereeing, here's what I'll tell you. From 2000, probably 2004 to 2009, I thought John Cal, who's the current Big East coordinator of officials, was the best in America. His approach to the game, he was a student of the game. As he neared retirement, he did things like started doing yoga classes, Pilates, to make his physical body continue in the, you know, things like that. People that take the extra time, effort, energy at the craft, those are the guys that should be claimed as quote unquote the best. But in reality, each of those players we talked about on the NBA had different skills. That, you know, Will Chamberlain, certain mold. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, certain mold. Michael Jordan, certain mold. They did a lot of things in a great way. There were some things they couldn't do. And so when you look at officials are the same way. Some of them are really good on their call accuracy. Some are really good at their consistency. Some are average communicators or communicate in a harsh way instead of a more kind way, whatever it is. I think you have to look at each individual in their own. Well, you said it earlier, Steve Ballmer. You would say he's best college referee I ever had. And yet in the same sentence, you said he was a horrible play caller because he never blew his whistle. Okay. I think Steve Ballmer is one of the best ever. I think he was way ahead of his time, maximized things. He's a dear friend. He was without question, the greatest communicator we ever had. But would I put him on the same category with Jim Burr and John Cal as an example? No, I wouldn't. So I know that's a great answer to
you. No, it's actually a fair answer. We usually in TV and radio we don't do that. It has to be one. Yeah. Has to be one or the other. Greatest individual performance that you were officiating a game, and I'll give you like a story is. Bill Self told me, you know, they had Kevin Durant play at Fog Allen Fieldhouse and Danny Manning was assistant. And Danny turned to Bill late in the game. It was say one, but I think Durant had like 43 or something. And Danny Manning, who's, you know, in any conversation of the greatest college player ever, had the greatest season ever, and they won national championship, turned to Bill and goes, "That's the baddest motherfucker that's ever played on this floor." That's what he said. So there are these individual moments where you see, and I've always found one of the things I love doing is when I talk to the officials before calling a game, it's like, well, who have you been doing? Who's good? Who do you like? And because officials know, like you sure. know if teams sure. are yelling, if not. So, but give me a individual performance. You were officiating a game and this was one that sticks out at you.
From a player perspective.
Yes.
So in, gotta think of the year. It might have been 2008 prior to the Olympic team going to the Olympics, I went to Vegas. I think three of us went to Vegas and because I was FIBA official and worked their week-long camp. At that time, you know, these are the NBA guys. These are the best, right? At that time, Kobe was the man, without question. LeBron wanted to be the man. And while everybody else in the gym was walking up and down the floor, maybe jogging up and down the floor, those two went at each other for a solid week, every play, without hesitation, over and over and over. And at that time, Kobe schooled LeBron without question. Kobe had gears, Kobe had abilities, and he put them all on the line during that week that didn't matter. That may have been the best true performance that I saw in all my years. And I got to, work in the Big Ten, ACC, Big East for a number of years. I got to see some really great players with some really great performances. Saw a kid in Kansas versus maybe South Dakota or North Dakota. Kid put 63 up in an NCAA tournament game, something crazy like that. But LeBron and Kobe going at each other for a week was and I was aware enough that I was able to acknowledge it while it was going on and just enjoy the heck out of it.
Your favorite place to officiate a game?
Well, I would have to break that down into levels, okay. Meaning, at the small college level, I worked a lot of games here in Indiana, and Bethel College used to have a gym that held maybe 1,000 people. And you get that tournament, the Crossroads League, you get the Crossroads League playing a game at Bethel for the semifinals or finals. People are crawling all over you. There's a stage at one end. It was phenomenal. Moving up a level, you go to the Division I level. Roberts Arena in Evansville, Indiana is where Evansville used to play. And the seats were right down on the floor. I mean, the front row, the high dollar seats were just, I mean, you had 6 inches of space. Same thing's true at Kansas. There's no space. And having that environment on top of you, I would consider Duke and their arena to be very similar. That feeling of everyone is on top of you is a very unique and really cool place. Then you move up to the larger arenas, and I worked a lot of games in the Big Ten, and going to Wisconsin and having that fan base who maybe, rabid's not the right word, but they bleed red, man. They bleed red. Ohio State, big arena, feels the same way. Michigan State feels the same way. But there's arenas like that all over the country. But I got to tell you, working in San Antonio, the Final Four, 73,000 people in the arena, who knows how many millions watching on television. Those moments are really, they're really cool. And as a national coordinator, I've been able to experience 6 tournaments. 2020 got canceled, of course. But to see that from not a refereeing perspective, but from the other side of the coin, every Final Four is
special. What is it like to make that call or to get the call when somebody who is a staple of a Final Four isn't in the Final Four? What is that like for you?
When I started in 2015, 16 was my first tournament. I would say on general terms, I felt that we had 13 to 15 guys at that time who were qualified, skilled, and ready to work a Final Four. And so the pool, that's a good pool. This past year, I legitimately had 23 to 24 guys that rated out in such a way that they deserve to work the Final Four. They deserve to be on the floor. And only 9 of them get a referee. So I've had numerous occasions where I could not reward a particular individual that deserved to be there. And generally speaking, I don't make those calls to the guys who don't get a go. that day. I make them over the next month. I call them, we talk, just to let them know they didn't do anything wrong. It's purely, there, it's a numbers game to a certain degree, and conference representation, diversity, who worked at the last 5 years, that kind of thing. So it's those calls get made. They're just made, after the fact. The calls that I enjoy more than anything, it's the best hour of this job. You know, you bust your hump for literally, my job is 12 months a year, 365 days a year, phone's always on. It's that 1 hour after, you know, say 3 o'clock on Monday after the regionals, from 3 to 4, I put in 10 phone calls this year, 11, because we had 2 standby officials. And I get to reward 9 guys who are going to be on the floor. And we laugh, we cry, we celebrate. The first timers, those that have never worked on the floor before, those are moments that you want to acknowledge it, and you also want to share in that celebration. Without question, they earn it. And I remember what that was like when I got that phone call. It used to be from an administrator at the NCAA and say, hey, you need to book a flight, we're going da da da. And I made sure that I personally called all those officials, because in a hard job, you want that moment where you can celebrate with people.
If someone were to ask you, like, obviously you made it, and but you had this whole other life as a CEO. There's a guy, he's 22, 23, loves ball, right? He goes and he officiates at an AAU event. Parents are all over him. Coaches are all over him. You're like, I actually love doing this, but yeah, I don't know if I, what would you tell him in terms of the journey of, you know, the idea of making it to a Final Four? It's really, really hard. These 9 guys on planet Earth get to officiate Final Four, but you can still make a great life for yourself, enjoy all these benefits, be around college basketball, make some good money. And eventually it could be something that stands on itself. As an official, not have to do anything the rest of the year. What would your advice be to somebody who's thinking about getting into it?
Well, that's a mouthful question right there. You just asked. My answer is, we need you. The game of basketball, football, whatever it is, we need you. We need positive people influencing young players. Whether it's an eighth grade AAU or whether it's, no matter what the level is, we need you and the sport needs you, and you can learn to excel at it as an individual and a team. We need you. That's the message. And I'll tell you a quick story. I won't put names or teams on it, but I have an event at every Final Four. It's called the Next Generation Seminar, and we work with the local host. So this year it was in New Orleans. So the Louisiana High School Athletic Association provided us 70 up and coming officials, male and female, high school guys and gals. And we put a seminar on for them where we have on the floor stuff. We have classroom stuff. I spoke to them for an hour. I brought in Monty McCutcheon from the NBA. I brought in Gene Steratore to talk to him about communication. We gave a really, really good training session to these officials in hopes to move them in their own journey. Those same officials on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday referee USA basketball games. They referee the managers' games. There's games going on all around. And at one particular managers' game on Sunday morning, a team's managers were playing. So the head coaching staff showed up to support their managers and proceeded to rip on the officiating crew like it was a Division I crew. One of the young men, his name's Joe, took a pretty serious beating. And at the end of the day, I had someone present there, and they went and addressed the coaches and finally got them to settle down and exit. And the officials were allowed to continue officiating. I called Joe, first year official. He's just trying to learn, just wants to get better. He wants to be that guy refereeing your kids, 7th, 8th, 10th grade, whatever game it is. And my message to him was the same I just gave you. Hey, Joe, we need you. Don't let this one situation cause you to be disgusted by the game, walk away, and you're never going to officiate again. We need you. And I would, anybody that asked me, I think youth sports is critical to our success in all of sport, and to have officials that are willing to do that and, yeah, earn a few bucks, try to excel, maybe get to a next level, whatever that is. We need officials in the game. And that's my message.
How do we fix the parent behavior? How do we fix it?
I was on a podcast. I was on a podcast recently, and they drove at the officiating side of this. What do we need to tell the officials? And the answer to that question, I said, is reversed. It's not the officials that we need to be talking to. It's the coaches. It's the players. It's the parents. It's the fans. I am a huge supporter of an organization called Officially Human. And for anybody that wants to know about it, you can go to officiallyhuman.com. Brenda Hilton, who's a Big Ten employee, runs it. And the goal of the organization, they have a series that a little league program can adopt. They make their parents watch a 2-hour video, do testing, blah, 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 to try to teach parents and fans how to be parents and fans and to support those children. I think that's where our efforts need to be placed. Sounds like a pipe dream, but we have to start somewhere. It's less about the officials and more about parents, coaches, and fans.
I would agree. They all follow the coach. Whatever the coach, you're not coaching it, you're allowing it, right? If you're not coaching it, you're right. Allowing it. And it doesn't just mean your players. It also means your parents as well. All right. So November 1st, you're going to be up in Traverse City at the other spot, and you're going to turn your phone off, right? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, I have loved college basketball for so long that I am not going to walk away from it. There's too many people involved that I think I have value to add. But as far as having the responsibility of particularly this job and or any other job, it's time for me to step aside and to let someone else in this role that has new ideas, new approach, new passion, take what we've done in 7 years and move it to another level. But yeah, I'm going to be at the cabin a little bit more. And by the way, where my cabin's at, there's a 17-mile radius where there's no cell towers. So even if they try to call while I'm there, not going to get me. It's pretty quiet. It's pretty quiet up there.
That's amazing. It's an amazing retirement that's well earned. And your time, I truly appreciate it. You took a lot of time out of your day for me. And thank you so much. And more importantly, thanks so much for what you've done for the sport, because you and I both have an incredible amount of love for the sport. And, you know, every bit of energy has been given back is incredibly important. So thank you. And thanks for joining me.
You know what, Doug, thanks for it's really been fun to talk about all the things that we've talked about. We covered a lot of ground. Again, I've loved the job that I've had, and it's just time. But more importantly to you, thank you for I look at this as an opportunity to educate and inform all of your listeners about who we are as officials and the professionalism that we as officials bring to the table. And I hope it makes a difference in somebody's viewpoint.
It's interesting because where it changed for me, I think it was Jim Burr. Boog and I were doing a tournament in Puerto Rico. And Jimmy he was going to dinner and all the officials were going or whatever. And like, why don't you guys come along? And I can't tell you how many of these guys that are your high level guys, there were young guys there coming up, and they were just kind of, we were all just kind of flies in the wall for old Jim Burr's stories, whatever. But once you get to know them, you get like, it's like the website you're giving out. They are human, you know, this guy's wife's pregnant, this guy's trying to have a baby, this guy's single guy. Right. And you start to, like, I like these guys. They love ball too, right? They love ball too. That's the best part about it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being on, Doug.
Thank you.
Good luck to you.
Same, likewise.
All right.
All right, my thanks to J.D. Collins. That was amazing. Remember, you can download and listen, subscribe, rate, write a review. Listen to part one as well. We got great stuff along the way. I do think we're going to have the Warriors and the Celtics in the NBA Finals. I think I predicted that maybe to start, or did I have the Nets? But I thought maybe Ben Simmons was going to play. I don't know. Celtics have been, they've been really impressive. I'm still not willing to put the East above the West. But part of that is I also consider the West with Kawhi, and I'm thinking of, you know, Jamal Murray being with the Nuggets, and neither played for either two. When healthy, I still think the West has greater teams, and I think the Warriors, I identified them as the best before the playoffs. Last year, I told you, check out that podcast. I told you they had something special in Jordan Poole. I didn't know it would come together this well, but I'm pleased nonetheless. Anyway. Thanks so much for listening. Remember, the Doug Gottlieb Show is daily, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 3 Pacific, iHeartRadio, FoxSportsRadio.com, on the iHeartRadio app. In the meantime, download, rate, write a review. Support this thing. Tweet it out to a friend if you like it. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.